From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandy. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Kojo, and a salute to all the veterans.
Oh, yeah, today is indeed Veterans Day, therefore a salute to you too, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Patrick Woyan. He is the mayor of College Park, Maryland. He just won re-election there. Joining us now by phone is Ralph Northam.
Who?
He is the governor-elect of the Commonwealth of Virginia. He is a Democrat. Governor-elect Northam, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Kojo and Tom. It's great to be on your show again.
And congratulations to you. As usual, Tom and I will begin by discussing some general, in this case, related issues to what's happened in Virginia on Tuesday. The first one I'd like to look at, Tom, and by the way, if you have questions or comments for Governor-elect Northam, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. The question, Tom, has to do with a year from now, what will this Tuesday's election mean for the political future of Congresswoman Barbara Comstock, the Republican in Northern Virginia, the only one elected to this Congress in Northern Virginia? Given the nature of the Democratic turnout, given of the nature of the Democratic victory here, given the nature of the Democratic opponents that she'll be facing, what's likely?
I don't think we know. I know that the Democrats are all excited, but, you know, I always try to tell people that we're living in essentially a political popcorn machine. There are things that are happening so fast on the national and local levels that I think if you tried to sit down and say, here's what's going to happen next year, you would be, I think, wasting your time. I'd love to hear the governor-elect's thoughts about this, because if I can just bring him in on the excitement of the Democrats. Governor, I wrote this question down because I think it's important. In the final weeks of your campaign, the polls showed your margin over Ed Gillespie, the Republican, closing, and worried Democrats publicly started stepping up criticism that your campaign was too moderate, that you were too dull, that you weren't firing up the base, that African Americans weren't enthusiastic. And now the Democrats have switched and they're all saying, hey, this is great. We're going to beat all the Republicans next year, too. How do you feel about the last weeks of the campaign, not just the negative ads, but the public trashing of your campaign? And did your internal poll show that slide or hint at the big win that you actually got?
You can answer any one of those five questions first.
That was a lot of stuff. I apologize. But it was a big deal.
Well, obviously, we were following internal polling, and, you know, we were confident, but certainly weren't taking anything for granted. But, you know, we ran a campaign with a positive vision for Virginia, and I think that message resonated across the Commonwealth. And this was a mandate on Tuesday that said that, you know, Virginians are sick and tired of the divisiveness. They're sick and tired of the types of ads that promote hatred and bigotry. And we want a positive vision. And, you know, we ran, Kojo and Tom, on economic opportunity for all Virginians, no matter who you are, no matter where you are in Virginia. We talked about our children having access to a world-class education, talked about Virginians having access to affordable and quality health care, living in environments where the air and water are clean, living in safe communities where there are not guns on every street corner, and then living in inclusive communities. And that's what resonated, and I think that's what Virginians voted for on Tuesday. And so I think it was a message for folks not only in Virginia but around this country that we can run a positive campaign, be successful. That's what Virginians are interested in.
And to Kojo's question about Barbara Comstock, she replaced Frank Wolf, a longtime Republican in that district. She's tried to run a middle ground of not being too Trumpish but also being conservative. From your perch now, heading towards the governor's office, what do you think about the Barbara Comstock possibilities for your party?
Well, obviously, that's going to be a competitive race and one we'll focus on. You know, Tom, we talked about, you know, what people were talking about in the Commonwealth of Virginia during this campaign, and certainly the detrimental policies that are coming out of Washington. are eye-opening. Things like the travel ban, the Muslim ban, you know, the pulling away from the Paris Accord, reversing DACA, and now the health care plan that was put on the table that puts, you know, up to 30 million Americans at risk of losing their coverage. This is, you know, these policies are not in anybody's best interest in Virginia. Virginia spoke. They said they wanted a governor that would stand up to those policies and also one that would take Virginia to the next level. So that's really what we focused on, and I think those are the results that we saw on Tuesday.
You said all that without saying the Trump effect.
when you looked at your polling and when you looked at how this race was likely to turn out, did you feel that President Trump would be a factor in how Democrats would fare in general and in your case in particular in this election?
We felt that it would be a factor, but again, this was an election about Virginia. And I think Virginia knew that I had, you know, served. I'd been a public servant all my life. I've taken care of sick children and their families for over 25 years. I'm a veteran of the United States Army. And I talked about a positive vision. And again, I think really that's what resonated and that's what people voted for on Tuesday.
Well, all of the people on your ticket won. Justin Fairfax is going to be the lieutenant governor. Mark Herring will win another term as attorney general. But did you expect what happened in the House of Delegates, the kind of wide advancement that Democrats made with so many women being elected, a transgender person elected, the first lesbian in the House of Delegates, the first Asian American, the first two Latinas? Did you anticipate all of that, or were those just wild hopes on your part?
Well, it's interesting, and as I traveled around and listened to, you know, different groups across Virginia, I saw so much enthusiasm, so much excitement. So a lot of my message, Kojo and Tom, was that we have an opportunity this year not only to elect three statewide, but to take our majority back in the House of Delegates. And I said many times, I said, we have 34 Democrats. There are 17 seats that are currently held by Republicans that Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine won in 2016. I said, we can do this. And we have come very close, as you know. We picked up 15 seats. There are two that are, you know, being looked at closely. And so now, right now, as it stands, we're at 51 Republicans, 49 Democrats, and we could get to 50-50. So I was optimistic all along. I think people kind of said, no, it can't happen. But, you know, there was so much enthusiasm, and I felt that as we traveled across Virginia, that I thought it was certainly doable.
If you get to that 50-50, you potentially have the power to influence that balance by bringing one or more Republican members of the House of Delegates into your administration. Has that been something you've given any thought to?
Right now, Kojo, we're talking about transition. I want to make sure that I put great people in these cabinet positions, and so I've been starting the interview process. I have a transition team that I've set up. So, you know, that's really what I'm focused on right now, and I'll let the caucus chairman, you know, and chair ladies deal with that in both the House and the Senate.
Well, we've been talking only about winning so far, but Barbara in Fairfax County wants to talk about, well, something else that's not winning. Barbara, your turn.
Yes, thank you. And Governor-elect Northam, I want to say thank you so much for running a positive campaign. You made me proud to be a Democrat. And I stood in the rain for you for 2 hours on Election Day handing out sample ballots. And I smiled all day because this is the first time I felt hopeful in an entire year. So thank you. I was a doubter of your positive campaign, and I'm sorry that I was. You knew what we needed. And you took the high road. The one thing I want to say is, as a rural girl from Pennsylvania who lives here now in diverse Fairfax County, please don't forget those rural areas in Virginia. I look at the results in those counties. I know they're unfortunately not on board with much of the Democratic agenda. And I want to give those people a reason to understand who we are and what we stand for, and we really have their best interests at heart. So,
How do you get those red counties on board, Governor-elect?
Barbara, thank you so much for your statement you just made, and thank you for all of your work. And there were a tremendous number of folks that, you know, helped me. They were out at the polls. They were out in the rain, and And I couldn't have done it without you. And every time I had a chance, I said, this is a team effort. And that's what I saw across Virginia, was that enthusiasm. Regarding rural Virginia, as most of you all may know, I am from Virginia's Eastern Shore. I grew up on a small farm. I have worked very hard all my life, but I've had great opportunities. And, you know, we have made tremendous progress building the new Virginia economy. We've made progress in rural Virginia, but we still have work to do. And so I intend to travel around the Commonwealth and make sure that we lift all of Virginia up. And, Barbara, there are things like access to universal broadband that we're going to work on, cell coverage. I want to expand the University of Virginia WISE to bring more talent to that area that will really help workforce development. We have the opioid crisis, and certainly as a doctor, I am very sensitive to what's going on in that area. So I will promise you, I will always look out for all of Virginia, but in particular, to your question, to rural Virginia, it's very important to me.
Governor, like, I think that caller just described the National Democratic Party
dilemma
that it has, being the bi-coastal party. But let me ask you about, already with the House of Delegates up for grabs here, Kirk Cox of Chesapeake is intended to be the Republican speaker should the Republicans control the House after all these votes are counted. He's already been quoted as saying that he will fight the, quote, extreme liberal agenda of the Democrats going forward. Just what does that mean to you? I think your campaign was opposite of extreme liberal agenda. You beat Tom Perriello by almost 10 points, or about 10 points, in the primary, and then you beat that he was the liberal, and now you've beaten the very conservative Ed Gillespie. Are you just a middle-of-the-road Democrat?
Well, first of all, you know, we're going to see what happens with this House of Delegates. You know, Speaker Cox, that's his position coming up if they keep the majority. And I have worked together in the past. I work with him on the smoking ban in restaurants. And as you know, he's an educator, and I'm very, very focused on K through 12 education, pre-K, making sure that our colleges and universities are affordable, making sure that we have access to our 23 great community colleges. I have a G3 program, Get Skilled, Get a Job, and Give Back, which allows individuals to go to our community colleges without incurring any debt. So, you know, depending on who's at the table, Kojo and Tom, I will work with them, and I certainly feel strongly about my principles and values, but I'm open-minded, and at the end of the day, I want to do what's in the best interest of the Commonwealth of Virginia and our people.
I was over in Annapolis yesterday at a press conference with Governor Larry Hogan, very popular Republican governor of Maryland. He came into the state last Saturday and campaigned for Ed Gillespie. And I asked him about that, and he said, well, you know, Gillespie got more Republican votes than any other Republican ever had, but unfortunately the Democrats got more votes than that. But he campaigned against you. Can I see you in Maryland this coming year campaigning against Mr. Hogan?
Well, I'm focused on Virginia. I don't plan on going too far, but I do look forward to working with Governor Hogan, especially with the Metro you know, challenge that we have. We want to make sure that Metro is governed, and also that we find a dedicated source of revenue for Metro. And that's going to take someone that's, you know, has some leadership qualities, that can sit down with the governor of Maryland, sit down with folks in Washington, D.C., and do what's in the best interest of Metro and Northern Virginia. Vitally important to the economy up there, and I want to make sure that we make that efficient and safe.
It's crucial to both Northern Virginia and the suburban Maryland jurisdictions. Everybody who rides Metro would be very happy if you and Governor Hogan, if he succeeded next year, and Mayor Bowser come up with a way to fix our Metro system. Thanks.
Absolutely. In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Ralph Northam. He is the governor-elect of the Commonwealth of Virginia. He's a Democrat. Here is Asal in Alexandria, Virginia. Asal, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much, Kojo. And Governor-elect, thank you for your service to our country. I am an Army veteran. And as you know, there's always been a huge gap between the Democratic Party and the veterans and our armed forces. And I was wondering, with the wonderful opportunity that you have now, considering your background in the United States Army, and the fact that a lot of Virginians can relate to your vision clearly, what are your plans to reach out to those veterans that are in the middle of the road who would never consider voting Democrat in 2020 but can be influenced by a governor that speaks to them instead of about them or around them? What are your plans as far as reaching out to those veterans?
Well, Assal, first of all, thank you for your service, and to all the other veterans that are watching and those that are listening, rather than those that are not, we thank you for your service and also those on active duty. I, as you said, served in the United States Army for 8 years. I took care of wounded soldiers during Desert Storm. In the last 4 years, our administration, with the leadership of Governor Terry McAuliffe and I and some other great people, have done everything that we can to make sure that Virginia is the most veteran-friendly state in the country. We were the first state to effectively end homelessness. That was through the Mayor's Challenge, something that we're very proud of. We had over 1,200 homeless veterans in Virginia, and we all found that as unacceptable. We have also promoted their highly useful skills and training that they've had in the military and helping them enter our workforce in Virginia. We have the V3 program, which is Virginia Values Veterans. Our goal was to hire over 20,000 veterans by 2018. We've gone past that. We've gone past 25,000 and now are up to almost 30,000. So that's something that we're very proud of, and I will continue that, and I would like to double that in the next 4 years. Something else I saw that is very important to me is transitioning. When our active duty members leave the military, we want to make sure that they have opportunities. If they want to be an entrepreneur, start a business, if they have issues with post-traumatic stress disorder, we want to make sure that they're wanted in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So it will be something that's very important to me and my administration as we move forward. And again, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that Virginia is the most veteran-friendly state in the country.
Governor-elect, I was, again, in Maryland, Governor Hogan said yesterday for the third time in a year in a row he is going to try to get the state of Virginia to exempt the military pensions. He says there are 400,000 retired military veterans in the state of Maryland. He thinks that they should not be state taxed on their pensions. Right now, the Democratic legislature has only given a $10,000 exemption. I'm not sure what the law is in Virginia, but do you think that's a good idea to exempt the military pensions from state taxes?
Well, Tom, one of the things that we are looking at and something I surely want to do as we move forward is look at comprehensive tax reform. We need a tax code in Virginia that is simpler, that's fairer, that's fiscally responsible, that protects our AAA bond rating. So I'll bring people to the table from both sides of the aisle to do that. But that will certainly be part of that discussion as we move forward.
You took some heat from immigrant groups and from progressives when you came out late in the campaign and declared that you never supported sanctuary cities. Virginia, of course, has no sanctuary cities, but several progressive groups nevertheless pulled support from you near the end. What do you want to say to them, those who felt let down by your apparent pivot toward the center, and what does it say about the kind of governor you plan to be?
Well, first of all, Kojo, to your point, we do not have sanctuary cities in Virginia. It was a political ploy. We need to put that behind us. As you know, we have the Dillon Rule in Virginia, so that really would prevent an individual locality or city from declaring themselves a sanctuary city. So it was a political ploy. We need to put it in our rearview mirror. And at the end of the day, what we need to talk about is how to drive our economy and how to make Virginia inclusive, how to welcome immigrants to the Commonwealth of Virginia. We need to stop the fear-mongering that's coming out of Washington and making sure people that feel that they want to live here in Virginia work and raise their family. So that's what I'll do as I move forward and try to put as best we can some of these political games behind us.
Would you take out of the election in terms of the aforementioned moderate position that you took about whether in the future in Virginia the party would run progressive campaigns or run as moderates? You got a Democratic socialist who won without the party's support in Manassas, Lee Carter.
Well, obviously we're progressive in Virginia, and they spoke on Tuesday, and so there are social issues that really impact our inclusivity, and so things, Kojo, like the attacks on women's reproductive health care, the discrimination against the LGBTQ community. Those things need to stop, and that's what people said on Tuesday. And so I hope everybody out there hears that, and we need to get back and talk about things like our economy, making sure that there's economic opportunity for all Virginians, no matter who you are, no matter where you are, that our children have access to world-class education and that we have access to affordable and quality health care. That's what Virginia said on Tuesday, and that's the way I'll lead over the next 4 years.
Tom?
You know, there hasn't been a statewide woman elected in Virginia since Mary Sue Terry, when she was elected Attorney General. It's an extraordinary progression there in the state this past Tuesday. Emerge America, an organization that also has an Emerge Virginia, says women hold 6 of the 40 state Senate seats, and only about 19 of the 100 delegate seats are women. Out of the Congress, there are no female members of Congress from the Democrats. And out of the 18 cities in Virginia with 30,000 or more population, only 3 are led by women. Some people are thinking that Tuesday's election is turning the page on women being more involved in state politics. Do you agree?
I couldn't agree with you more, Tom. And, you know, you gave the numbers. And, you know, last time I checked, women make up over 50% of the population. And that's not the case. And so whether it be women or other, you know, areas of diversity, we need to have our policymakers reflect our society. My cabinet and my administration will reflect our society. But, you know, I think we had some great messages that were sent on Tuesday. One of them was that we want more women in leadership positions, and we also believe in diversity. And I'm very proud of what happened in Virginia on Tuesday.
Here is Mike in Tyson, Virginia. Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call, Kojo. Dr. Northam, congratulations on your win. I voted for you. I was very excited to do so. I think that this wave that you've mentioned here has definitely represented a lot of messages that we want to send, progressive messages, inclusivity, lots more women, minorities, progressive politics. But I want to know, how are you going to use this wave to advance some specific policy things, and specifically 3 things? One, I want to see finally Medicaid expansion come to the Commonwealth. I can't for the life of me understand what's holding this up apart from poor people suffering and somebody benefiting from that. 2, I want to see some improvement on tightening Virginia's notoriously loose gun laws that are feeding guns into the East Coast crime syndicates and criminal activity all over the East Coast of the United States. And 3, why is our minimum wage pegged still at the federal minimum? And that is definitely going to hurt us as surrounding states and the district raise their minimum wage, and that's going to end up costing us workers and competitive advantage economics.
Montgomery County just voted for a $15 minimum wage. But go ahead, please, Governor-elect.
Mike, thank you for the question. And, you know, you just mentioned 3 issues that I ran on for the last year, and they resonated with the Commonwealth of Virginia voters. The first of is minimum wage. I'll go in reverse order. There is no way that an individual, let alone a family, can support themselves on $7.25 an hour. And so I think you'll see legislation and certainly some ideas to increase minimum wage in Virginia, and I think there'll be tremendous support for that. The second that you mentioned is gun laws. You know, we have had so many tragedies, Mike. We had the recent tragedy in Las Vegas and then one right in San Antonio. And, you know, it's time for us as a society to sit down and talk about responsible gun ownership. I plan to continue that discussion. It's something that I have never been shy of, as you know. I told people I've made a lot of A's to get into medical school, but the F that I'm proudest of was my F with NRA, and I will continue to do what I can to stand up to them and make sure that we have responsible gun ownership in Virginia. And then finally, Medicaid expansion. There are 400,000 working Virginians right now that don't have access to health care, and that is immoral. You know, we're all going to have a day when we need to go see the doctor. And from a business perspective, every day that we don't expand Medicaid, not only are we leaving on the table, but we're giving to other states who we compete with over $6 million a day. So we've given away over $10 billion. So I plan to, since January of 2014, so I plan to bring people from both sides of the table and make sure that all Virginians have access to affordable and quality care, and I look forward to leading that discussion.
Tom Sherwood.
Well, I have a very serious question for you. Will you, when you move into the governor's mansion, will you keep Governor McAuliffe's beer kegerator in the governor's mansion? I haven't gotten down there yet to try it, but I don't know that you're a beer drinker or not, but...
We have actually had that negotiation. The beer kegerator will remain. He had said, though, that he wants to take the handle with him, and so we'll have to design a new handle, but the kegerator will remain in the governor's mansion.
And when is the inauguration? Now, you say you have your inauguration committee. I assume you have an inauguration committee that you'll be putting together, a transition committee.
Yes, it'll be the second week in January, but I don't have a calendar in front of me, Tom, so I don't know the exact day, but we'll get all that information out.
Are there any people from Northern Virginia who you've already selected to be on your transition committee?
I was actually going to talk to you and Kojo about that, so it's
you don't
a good
pay
time.
Enough. But
no, yeah. we are interviewing and talking to a lot of folks, so I'm looking forward to the process as we move forward.
There's been a great deal of talk about Trumpism without Trump and Ed Gillespie's tap dance in trying to win over Trump voters without actually embracing the president's policies and message. Some, including President Trump and Trump before Trump, Corey Stewart in Prince William County, say Gillespie lost because he did not fully embrace Trump. Where do you think that strategy would land Republicans in Virginia? Does it, for instance, give Corey Stewart a better chance at beating Senator Tim Kaine?
Well, that's a discussion, Kojo, they're going to need to have. But I will tell you what my message was, which you already heard, and what resonated with Virginia. So I think some of the divisiveness, the promotion of the hatred and the bigotry, I mean, we saw some of his response, Mr. Trump's response to what happened in Charlottesville. Virginians stood up and said, enough is enough. That's not the Commonwealth of Virginia that we're going to live in. It's not what we condone. And so our positive message resonated, and I think people should take note of that.
You know, the last caller with his three-part question is an indication that the progressives in the state and around the country are going to be really after you to do a lot of things more progressively, and one of them will be out of the Charlottesville violence of last August, is to take a tougher stand on the monuments in Virginia, the Confederate monuments. I'm coming down to Richmond tomorrow. I'll be on Monument Avenue. How will you handle this going forward, this sensitive issue?
Well, Tom, I appreciate the question. And, you know, I was in Charlottesville, and we lost two of our state troopers. We lost Heather Heyer. And, you know, if a statue gave these white supremacists an excuse to come into a beautiful city, a wonderful University of Virginia, with spewing just hatred and bigotry and violence, then we need to have a discussion about these statues. And so if there are statues that are divisive, that promote hatred and bigotry, I think they should be in museums. I have left that up to the localities. Furthermore, Tom, what I would say, there are monuments that are not built of bronze. There are tremendous inequities that we are facing in Virginia, such as access to health care, access to education, access to voting. These are all discussions that we need to have as we move forward.
You did say repeatedly during your campaign that you'd be willing to work with President Trump on issues benefiting Virginia. I was trying to think of what an example of such an issue might be, but I think Maria in Virginia has hit on the issue. Maria, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. I am a Latina immigrant who lives in Virginia. I moved here 17 years ago from Ecuador, and right now I work for a nonprofit. It's called Edu Futuro, and we work with empowering immigrants with education programs. And we have seen the great impact, of course, with the situation that's going on right now with with the persecution to our immigrants. And that's affecting our programs for sure. But you already talk about that, the sanctuaries, and I appreciate all the your plans to have an inclusion policy. I voted for you, and I'm really happy to hear that. But
okay, we need to get to the opioid issue,
yes,
Maria.
The opioid, yes. The opioid epidemic is affecting the whole community, as you know. And being a doctor, I am just hoping that you will get your hands into this as soon as possible, because it's affecting the communities. I work closely with schools, And we have offered different workshops to inform parents and to be with different prevention.
And I only interrupt because our time is short, but Governor-elect President Trump has declared the opioid crisis an emergency. Is that something that you think you could work with him on?
Well, absolutely, and that's a, you know, it's a tremendous challenge here in Virginia and for this country. We lost over 1,100 Virginians last year to opioid overdose. So as a doctor, it's certainly something I'm very sensitive to. I've already been working on it, but we'll continue that. And, Kojo, you talked about other areas. I mean, our president said he wants to expand the build up the military. We build the greatest ship warships and submarines right in Newport News. So there are areas that I can work with him on, but when there are detrimental policies coming out of Washington, I'll stand up to those.
Governor Terry McAuliffe spent his four-year term in a pretty combative relationship with the Republican-dominated General Assembly, including handing them a record number of vetoes. You, on the other hand, have long-time relationships with Republicans in the General Assembly from your time in the Senate. Of course, we do not know yet which party will be in control of the General Assembly, but if you can give us an indication of what your approach is likely to be in your relationship with the legislature.
Well, first of all, Kojo, Governor Terry McAuliffe has done a wonderful job in Virginia building the new Virginia economy, over 215,000 new jobs. Our unemployment rate has gone from 5.4 to 3.7%, the lowest it's been in 9 years. So he's been a great governor, and I'm a great friend of his, and we've done some good things in Virginia. As far as, you know, working with the legislature, I've been there for 10 years. I have great relationships with folks on both sides of the aisle. So you hear me talk about all the time the Virginia way. We agree to disagree, but at the end of the day, we're going to do what's in the best interest of Virginians.
Whether the Democrats control the 100-member House or not, it seems to me if it's going to be that close, one party, one delegate ahead of the other or something, it will force them to be to negotiate more rather than depend on you vetoing things.
Absolutely. And, you know, Virginia spoke on Tuesday. It's a new day that we woke up to on Wednesday. And that is that Virginians want people working together. And that's the kind of leadership qualities that I bring. And I look forward to that in the next 4 years.
Is Pam home packing?
Pam, you know,
wife.
Pam is going to do a lot of great work in early childhood education. And obviously, you know, she's very focused on the environment. And she's going to be a great first lady. So, yeah, we're making plans on how we can get everything moved to Richmond, especially our black lab, Murphy. We certainly want to make sure he's comfortable in Richmond.
Well, we only have about a minute left, but we got an email from Kat. Please ask Governor Northam how he's going to deal with MS-13, which is a real issue here in Northern Virginia. But Kat obviously has an ulterior motive because Kat also writes, we can be pro-legal immigration and still enforce federal laws. Pew Research, 300,000 undocumented immigrants in Virginia. It's a slap in the face to everyone who does it legally. So I guess you're being asked to address two issues, the gang issue and illegal immigration.
Well, I would just tell you the best way to deal with MS-13 is to support our law enforcement. And obviously, I've always supported our sheriffs and deputies, our state police, our local law enforcement agencies. We need to make sure that they're paid fair salaries, that they have good benefits, that they can take care of their families, that they can have good education, health care in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So that's the way we deal with gangs is with good law enforcement. And that's what I've always done. That's what I'll continue to do.
On the issue of immigration, illegal immigration?
We will let the federal agents, deal with their jobs. We will keep our local law enforcement, allow them to do their jobs, support them. And at the end of the day, Kojo, it is very important that Congress sit down at the table and put the politics aside and come up with comprehensive immigration reform. That would help a lot of these situations.
Ralph Northam is the governor-elect of the Commonwealth of Virginia. He is a Democrat. He just won election this past Tuesday. Once again, congratulations. Thank you for joining us. Tom Sherwood fully expects you to be on Monument Avenue waiting for him when he shows up there tomorrow.
I want a state police escort on Monument Avenue.
Thank you, Kojo and Tom. It's always good to be on your show, and I hope all your listeners are doing well.
Thank you, and good luck to you. This is, of course, the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with The Current newspaper. Joining us in studio now is Patrick Woyon. He is the mayor of College Park, Maryland. He just won re-election. He is a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo. It's great to be here.
Tom and I have one D.C. issue to discuss. Tom, it would appear that United Medical Center is no longer going to be run by the firm Veritas. The D.C. Council voted 7-6 not to renew that contract, despite apparent heavy last-minute lobbying from Mayor Muriel Bowser, who had gotten significant contributions from the people who run Veritas. But the council decided on a rather slim 7-6 margin not to renew that contract. What happens next?
Well, she got something like $35,000 from the various members of the family that own Veritas. Out of her $3 million campaign. I don't think that the issue was that Veritas was said by many folks not to be doing a good job. The problem with the council voting 7-6 to kill the contract is that Veritas may walk away from the contract, and there's nobody who's going to run the hospital. So the mayor and the council members have got to figure out how quickly they can either extend
the
Veritas.
And they need
to do
it by the end of this month. Because
yes, I think by December the 1st if they walk away. And so the issue is that the mayor and her And Vince Gray, who's the chairman of the health committee, despite the history of that 2014 race, and the council have got to get together and figure out what they're going to do about United Medical Center and the health care that the people in that part of the city need. And they can't have any personal irritations to get in the way of that. So you get a contractor who can run the place while they decide what to do with it.
First, congratulations on your reelection.
Thank you very much.
The local elections in College Park were most certainly overshadowed by events in Virginia, but things certainly got heated in your city of 32,000. This was the most contested election in the city's history, with 21 candidates running for 4 council seats and the mayor's office. What's going on?
Yeah, so a couple of different things. First of all, there's a lot going on in College Park right now. We're seeing a revitalization of our downtown area. We're seeing the Route 1 corridor just completely changing. And so I think there was a lot of interest in general about what's happening in our city, and a lot of interest in trying to shape what that means for College Park residents. And also, of course, there was a fairly controversial issue that came up in our council earlier this year, which was the vote around non-citizens voting.
That proposal to allow non-citizens to vote in College Park, a measure that ultimately failed, is apparently what sparked the large number of candidates on the ballot in College Park. Why was it so controversial, given that it's passed in other nearby jurisdictions, including Hyattsville and Mount Rainier next door?
Well, it got a lot of attention in the nationwide press, I think, in part because of College Park's importance as the home of the flagship university of the University System of Maryland. And it sparked, and I think with everything that's been going on over the last couple of years around our country, it got a lot of attention that otherwise wouldn't have.
Well, all the incumbents won, right?
That's right.
And you were a supporter of the non-citizen voting. You won.
That's right.
You won re-election. What does that say about how you feel about the issue now, and about whether there's a likelihood of a similar vote in the future?
Well, I think some of the challengers who ran really focused on this issue as their main issue that they were bringing up. One of my challengers, who is currently on the city council and ran for mayor, said that this was the main reason why she decided to run. And I think, although this is an important issue for College Park residents, I think mostly College Park residents were concerned about what's going on in the city and what we're doing to revitalize it. And really excited about the direction the city's going in right now.
So it was not the non-citizen voting issue, you think, that brought you back to victory. However, since you were a supporter of it, is it likely to be raised again on the council?
I'm not sure it will. The council sets the agenda, so I facilitate their what they want to work on. But personally, what I think we need to focus on, other ways to integrate and incorporate our immigrant communities into what we're doing in College Park. This was a very divisive issue, and it's not something that I necessarily want to see come up again. But I think there's many other things that we can do to celebrate the diversity in the immigrant community.
Sherwood and I thrive on divisive issues. You should know.
No, this is the politics hour. It's what works, you know. Exactly. I like to tell people, you know, several hundred planes take off and land every day at Reagan National Airport. We only care about the one that doesn't. Exactly. I mean, that's the nature of the news business. And so that brings me to the University of Maryland. How many students are there now?
It's approximately 39,000-40,000.
The town gown issues with College Park. A lot of people don't know College Park is kind of the core, as you just said, of the university. You only have like something like 32,000 people in your little town.
That's right.
But you do have ongoing issues. The student government president endorsed you for election. Where, if you're in that university community, what can College Park do to make the students more feel more welcome and also to get the students to realize they live in a small town?
Well, I appreciate you raising that, that President Pruitt endorsed me. I think it shows, because what we've been focused on in recent history in College Park is breaking down the divisive barriers that have existed between the student body.
The students feel like they're under attack by the police and ticketing and housing violations, all the other things.
Yeah, and
others say they deserve it.
And in the past, that's been a real challenge. Students have felt like the city is just out to stop them from having fun. The long-term residents have felt like the students are just trying to make their lives difficult and keep them up all night. What in the past few years, we've really focused on bringing the groups together to talk about win-win situations, how we can collaborate to allow students to get through their 4 years, have a good time, do so safely, while in the meantime allow the residents to live peacefully and be able to sleep all night so they can get up for work in the morning.
Well, the University of Maryland is investing heavily in Route 1, including a newly opened luxury hotel, restaurants, mm-hmm. a host of other development. What is the city government's relationship with the university, and what kind of leverage do you and the city council have in decision-making, given the size, given the scale of the University of Maryland? What kind of leverage do you have to ensure that residents' needs are factored into all this planning that the university is making?
Well, we have a strong relationship with the university. I think it's stronger than it's ever been, at least in recent history. And as a result, we've really been able to bring the needs of the residents to the table and make sure that the university understands that residents are live in the city and don't want to be overwhelmed by development. That we want to collaborate and work together with the university, take advantage of what the university has to offer.
What is the budget for your little town?
Right now, we're at about $19 million a year.
Ooh, that's actually larger than I expected.
Development is a huge issue in general in College Park. It's even the subject of a local website that's called Rethink College Park. What will the coming of the Purple Line, which will have, what, three stops in College Park? Four stops in College Park? What will that mean for the city, and how is development being planned around that?
It's going to have a significant impact on College Park, and it's going to give us new opportunities in terms of redevelopment. I think we should be focusing development around transit. We're looking at our two metro stations now, the College Park and Greenbelt Metro Station, which borders right in College Park, and how we can work on redeveloping those. But with College Park coming in, there will be a lot more opportunities for transit-oriented development.
How important is Metro to you? We just talked to the governor-elect in Virginia. Governor Hogan has been weighing in on various things to get Metro fixed. Do a lot of people in your town depend on Metro?
Absolutely. I moved to College Park because of Metro. I didn't own a car at the time when I moved to College Park, so we bought our house three blocks away from the Greenbelt Metro Station.
And you have a car now because you have to go to so many meetings probably.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about those meetings for a second, because when you guys vote on non-citizen voting, that vote was a bit of an embarrassment for the city council. No one at the time realized it required a supermajority to pass. Are you folks reading the procedural rules and bylaws more closely these days?
Yeah, certainly we are. And that's something that I promised during the campaign that if I were to be reelected, that I would make sure that we do our due diligence to make sure that nothing like that happens.
Is there a lawyer for the town lawyer?
He's a lawyer.
not a council lawyer who sits in on your sessions.
Yes, and
we blame him or her.
I was about to say his name is Patrick William.
Well, we all took responsibility jointly as a city for the oversights that we had on that issue, and And we are working with our attorney, with our staff, with the new incoming counsel, and myself. We're all working to make sure that these things don't happen again, that we do a thorough procedural review every time an issue like this comes up.
We got a tweet from Ian. There has been a lot of quick development in College Park. Is Mayor Wooyan concerned about development outpacing the community's ability to support it?
Well, that's always something we need to watch out for, and the rapid pace of development can be concerning. I think we do need to make sure that we have the infrastructure in place to handle the new development coming in, and that's why I think focusing on smart development, focusing on our metro stations is critical, focusing on the infrastructure that already exists.
Council Member Jack Evans, who's the chairman of Metro, but also the Finance and Revenue Committee in the district, talks about development. He says, whatever governments are doing, the cities or yours or others, is that economics of this region is that it's growing, and it's growing rapidly, even despite the cutbacks in the federal government, and that it's not whether you want it or not, it's whether you plan for it.
Exactly. And I think I hear some people say we should slow down the pace of development. I think you could stop development altogether in College Park and it wouldn't stop the traffic from coming in. In fact, it would just push development out further and likely make our traffic problem worse.
Do you happen to know the new mayor of Annapolis?
I have not met him.
Gavin Buckley?
I have not met him. I've heard a lot about him, though.
I was in Annapolis yesterday talking to him, and he was just a businessman. As he said, he came from Australia on a leaky boat and a couple hundred dollars in his pocket 25-something years ago. Now he owns several restaurants in the town. He said he wanted to be the mayor because he just wanted things to run better. And one of his big issues were crosswalks. And if you go to Annapolis, you know, they've got all those circles and winding roads, and the crosswalks are terrible. What's the big issue on traffic for you guys other than too much of it?
Well, certainly Route 1 is a big traffic problem, and traffic safety is a big concern for us. We've had – a few years ago, there were three deaths in one area of Route 1 in downtown College Park. There have been a couple – there was one death recently in another part of the city, just a little bit north of that. And we really need to tackle making our city more bikeable and walkable, and safer for pedestrians and cyclists.
The election may be over, but the politicking is not. We have on the phone one of Mr. Wooyan's challengers for the mayoralty, Mary in College Park, Maryland. Mary Cook, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo, for having me on today. I just want to correct what Mr. Wooyan had to say. It's the reason I decided to run for the office. It was not just because of non-citizens voting. I think a lot of people were unhappy with that issue, as well as other issues going on in College Park, the very ones you've been discussing right now. And I had a number of residents that encouraged me to run, and that those were the reasons that I was running, not just because of non-citizens voting.
Now that you have failed to win the mayoralty in College Park, will you continue to be involved in politics?
Will I continue to be involved in politics?
Yes.
I'm not sure right now. It's kind of early to say. But will I continue to be involved in the city of College Park? I certainly will.
Oh, I could answer that. Yep.
Do you want to respond to her?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I appreciate her clarifying that. But I was speaking based on her statements, which were reported in the Washington Post last week. As to why she said that she was running herself.
Yeah, I saw the same statements in the Washington Post. Mary, you better give them a call.
It's fake media.
Well, maybe I should give them a call because I certainly did not see them.
Well, let's look ahead.
We know how publications can be sometimes. They're not always correct.
Well, I don't want to offend the journalism business, but I don't want to take the time. Let's look ahead in the state. Governor Hogan's gearing up for election next year. Do you anticipate moving outside of College Park and being more active with the Democratic Party? Kathleen Matthews and others have said they've got to really gear up for next year. You can't just assume you can beat Hogan because people don't like Trump.
Well, I am very involved in what's happening on our state level and what's happening on the national level, and as all these issues impact College Park and impact its residents. And I would like to see continued investment in College Park and continued investment from the state level in our infrastructure. I'm very engaged in that and making.
Do you have
sure
a candidate for governor on the Democratic side? You've got about a half dozen to choose from.
Yeah. Well, at this point, I've worked well with Rashern Baker during my time as mayor and city council before that. I think he's been a great asset for our county. And I'm looking forward to seeing what he might be able to do as governor.
You know,
we got a minute left.
Well, I was going to say something just nice about Hyattsville and Mount Rainier and College Park. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, for people who are complaining about the price of houses in the district, maybe they ought to look over the line.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, you know, we have a lot going on in that Route 1 corridor between the district line and the Beltway. Mm-hmm. So I really encourage people to check it out.
Patrick Oyon, he is the mayor of College Park, Maryland. He just won re-election once again. Congratulations and good luck to you.
Thank you, Kojo.
We just mentioned Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker, Tom Sherwood. Aisha Braveboy, former member of the General Assembly, is launching a bid for Prince George's state's attorney. The current state's attorney, Angela Alsobooks, is running to replace Rashern Baker. The only other candidate for state's attorney at this point is State Senator Victor Ramirez, who generally wins that primary is generally the person who is going to be the next attorney general.
I think he can drop generally.
I think I've said enough.
But that's going to be a really good contest. You know, Angela Alsobrooks is running for county executive. You have a preference in that race yet, Mr. Mayor?
I haven't decided for certain. I've been meeting with a couple of the different candidates. And
well, you know, I think overall the races in both Montgomery County and Prince George's County, there is just total upheaval in terms of who's running for what office, whether it's the county executive of Montgomery or whatever. And the media has a lot to do to cover all of this.
Before we go, I would just like to bid farewell to Dolores Kendrick. She died this past week. She was the poet laureate of the District of Columbia since 1999, when she was first elected to a 3-year term, but held on to that position, had an office here, and was a mentor to a lot of poets in the city. She passed this way, past week. You may remember her father. Ike Kendrick was the publisher of the Capitol Spotlight newspaper back in the day, another loss for the city. But that's it for the show today, but there's always more for you online. It's a great day to subscribe to our podcast so you can take the show wherever you go this weekend. You can find us on iTunes and other podcast services. Don't forget to meet us back here at noon Monday. We're going to talk to a person that listeners of the Politics Hour know pretty well, former D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams. He wrote recently that major American cities would be better places if they weren't so often characterized by one-party rule, like D.C., and he's going to join us in the studio to explore that. Until then, have a great weekend, Tom Sherwood. You're headed over to Monument Avenue?
On Saturday, I'm going to Monument Avenue in Richmond, but I just want to again say I want to salute all the veterans.
Indeed, and salute to you too, Tom Sherwood. And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, and Avery Kleiman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Nandi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.